Yes, we've got Tom Pitowski and Michael Kennedy, who will be giving us an overview of the Oregon revenue projections.
And they come from?
Oh, I'm sorry. they come from the Department of Administrative Services. Tom is the budget and management, the state economist.
Thank you. You're certainly most welcome. We appreciate your coming.
Well, good afternoon, Mr.
Like
Chair.
Steve, you know, some of the, he brings bad news.
Yes, he has such a nice smile.
Yes, he does.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski, a state economist with the Department of Administrative Services. With me today also is Michael Kennedy, our revenue economist, which will give you a review of our March forecast that was just released not less than 2 weeks ago. Very briefly, as you know, with the we've pretty much believed the Oregon economy is in recession. You may have heard in the news that the U.S. economy may be coming out of recession, and this will be one of the mildest recessions on record for the United States. That is not quite the same story for Oregon. As I've said in other speeches, Oregon is a bit more of a manufacturing-based economy, and that's been the sector that's been the hardest hit during this recession. And consequently, we've experienced larger job drops than what's been true for other states in the U.S. In fact, we flip-flopped in terms of being at the top of the charts. In the mid-90s, we're at the top of the charts for income growth, manufacturing job growth, you name it. Now we're at the top of the charts for the wrong reasons. We're 50th in the nation for the percentage of jobs that have been lost. We're the top in terms of the unemployment rate, which hit 8% seasonally adjusted for January. And the Employment Department will be releasing this Friday February's numbers, and expectations are that picture may not change much at all, and we'll probably still stay in this 50th position that we find ourselves in. But anyways, that has consequently, of course, caused what you've seen in terms of drops in the revenue projections, and relative to what the appropriated budget was, that has meant some deficits in the budget that we've now had two special sessions, and undoubtedly a third one will be coming. So with that sort of revenue outlook, with this background of the economy, and I might add with the economy too, we expect that the recession will also end in Oregon. And we're looking for the bottom to be in the second quarter of this year, with mild growth through the second half and then continuing growth in 2003. But it won't be till 2003 that we reach employment levels that we had before this recession. So you want to keep that in mind, that the revenue summary that Michael will be talking about includes our outlook for the economy, in that we bottom out in the second quarter and we start to improve. So even though there's a deficit position, we still are looking at improvement that goes through into the basically throughout the full last fiscal year of this biennium period. So with that as a background, like Michael Kennedy talked a little bit about then our revenue projections.
Does that make your projection a conservative one, or are you would you say it's right on, or optimistic, or
what? Well, Senator Troy, we try our best that it's going to be a middle of the road projection, what we believe is our best probability of outcome, and so we think lesser probability would either be a more optimistic one or a more pessimistic one. We've, for example, our tracking of employment for the first quarter of this year, we were off less than 1%, actually less than 0.5%. And so we think we're getting a better handle on where this economy has settled into. And as you may know, any time you have a turning point and so on, both employment levels and revenue levels are very difficult to get the degree to which we think we have a good handle on them and the track that they're following. But we think now we've seen the recession, we're into it, we've seen the impacts, we've taken those into account. We think we're on a better track now of where this economy is heading.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee,
My name is Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis.
Michael, will you speak up nice and loud?
Certainly. Our latest revenue forecast, released March 1st, is now for a total general fund revenue receipts in this biennium of $10.2 billion. That is $148 million less than our December forecast, and more importantly, $814 million short of our close of session forecast. Let me break that down a little bit. First into personal income tax receipts, we now project those at $8.9 billion, and that is $115 million short of the December forecast and $590 million below our close of session forecast. So that's the predominant driver of the shortfalls relative to the close of session. In addition, corporate income tax receipts are projected at $635 million. That is $32 million short of the December forecast and $224 million short of the close of session. All other general fund sources amount to $751 in the forecast, and that's relatively unchanged from either the December or the close of session forecast.
So if we consider a current service level projection for the next biennium, do you find us short quite a bit of money in terms of our revenues anticipated to pay for what we're going to do the next biennium?
I haven't looked at the expenditure side in the coming biennium closely as of yet, okay. So I don't have an exact answer for that.
Senator Troe, if you would turn to page 8 in our handout that you have that's entitled Oregon Economic and Revenue Forecast. The 03-05 biennium period, if you compare, there's a comparison of the December forecast with the March forecast, and that's at the top of the page on page 8. You can see that we've dropped that down approximately in the neighborhood of $300 million. Projections before were that we might be looking at anywhere from a $500 million to possibly $1 billion shortfall. Basically, it would just be adding this amount onto that as a shortfall from our projections.
So, what we need to get out of this, I suppose, is we understand the limits of what we're doing as a task force on libraries, is the fact that the state does have significant revenue problem that's going to continue into the next biennium, so there's not a lot of additional money to do anything.
I think that's the correct characterization. I will say, Senator Troe, to the extent that the special sessions are balancing out expenditures to the revenues, and that becomes a view of a new base level to have current service level built off of that, then the shortfall will be less in numbers.
Right.
The fact that services will be less overall is, of course, larger.
Just means that the cuts made during this biennium will be permanent and carried over into the next biennium.
It's very possible.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions, folks, for these? Do you have additional things that you want to present?
If I may, with the committee, the summary of the numbers are on page 7 of your handout that we're looking at for both the general fund for lottery resources.
Often when we begin a biennium, we have a fairly large beginning balance. Right now, you don't project any beginning balance at all, do you?
To the extent, if everything would stay the same as the close of session forecast that we did back in May, and at that time when we had the legislatively approved budget put forward, I believe there was an ending balance of somewhere about $96 million. If, depending on the balancing that is done through the special sessions, that amount will either stay, depending on your decision making, it could be at that level, it could even be less. And it is all dependent on what, how you rebalance that budget.
Right. Mm-hmm. We find some additional permanent revenue to go along with the permanent cuts we have to make.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Carol.
I'm not sure I understand this completely, but the federal government just passed the tax relief package, and included in that was in the Oregonian today was mentioned that this is going to further impact Oregon because of how that's playing out. I guess it is either on corporate taxes, but could you just talk about that a bit, what they're getting at?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Baker, yes, just passed by the House and the Senate, and undoubtedly will be signed by President Bush, includes an accelerated depreciation for businesses of an additional 30%. And at the moment, we're working both with the Legislative Revenue Office and Department of Revenue to assess what that may be. To give you an idea, though, this was the same basic House bill, 30, 40, something like that, that was talked about last October. And it's pretty much the same form. And back there, estimates that were being made were somewhere in the neighborhood of, it could possibly be another $120 million down for this biennium period, and possibly $60, $70 million down in 03, 05. But as I said, we're presently looking at that. Our forecast, we consider what we call as current law forecast. And so as soon as that becomes current law, and we have our consultations with the other two groups I mentioned, then we will include those impact in the June forecast. But it is possible that those sort of numbers are what we'll end up including as additional drops in revenues.
So the information you're giving us now does not include that. But
that is correct.
May well be there.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now we can go to John. Oh,
yes.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Jenny, how come we don't get those?
How come you don't get what?
Everybody would like a button that says congratulations to the Multnomah County Library for 100 years of service.
Yeah. So.
And Jenny's having a big party up there. So,
hey,
Mr. Chair and Senators and my colleagues, thanks for letting me be here to represent the Oregon Library Association. I think what I'm going to talk about, and I will try to keep an eye on the clock, is stepping back a little bit from Jim gave an overview of specifics of where we are in terms of the lay of the land of libraries, and Patty talked about the core legislation of some possibilities of where we'd like to go. I want to talk about the Vision 2010, and I think everybody got the blue handout, which are my slides, and I know the senators got a copy of the Oregon Library Quarterly in the fall that was our Vision 2010 statement. The Vision 2010 grew out of a task force of the Library Association that was formed in 1999, and Deb Carver chaired that. It was a very interesting, representative, lively group of people. And what we were trying to do, or what we were charged to do, was give a roadmap to the association for the next 10 years. Some ideas of where libraries might be going, what Oregonians might want in terms of their libraries and in terms of their access to information. So what we did was meet a lot, I think as all of you would recognize. We tried to do a fairly straightforward strategic plan, goals, our mission statement, our goals and objectives. We just found that didn't work for us. So instead, we came up with this issue of the quarterly, which gives, it's interesting reading, if nothing else. It gives scenarios of different ways that libraries could go, some good, some bad. It's a wake-up call. We're trying to get librarians to really think about that things are changing. The world we live in is changing. We have a crossword puzzle. There's a quiz you can take to see how savvy you are. So it's a very different approach to a vision. There is a call to action, though, that were the seven items that we identified as possibilities that the Library Association and libraries in Oregon should really look at pursuing. I think, as I said, As I said, it's kind of a little bit of the roll of the dice of what we were doing, but we thought that maybe it would get people galvanized to action. We started by looking at what risks were facing Oregon's libraries, and libraries in general. We did this by taking an overview of the state of Oregon. I was kind of surprised to find that we couldn't go out there and find in one document a scan of Oregon, of what was going on with the demographics, what was going on with the economy, where the state was going to be going and what its people might be like over the next few years. So we did that. Then we did a scan of the libraries in the state, very much what Jim presented today. And then we looked at general trends in the profession. And out of all of that, we came up with three risks, overarching risks that we thought we were facing. One is that libraries, we tend to move at kind of, we can move at very slow paces. We're not always risk takers. I think Carol would agree with me on that. And often that will lag behind the rate of change in our communities. We do have risk takers in our communities. Our plan, we feared, might be so broad or so inclusive, we might try to do everything that we couldn't do anything. It wouldn't have power or focus or significance. And overall, we thought that our libraries, really valuable resources, the collections and the people that are and their expertise, would be underutilized and opportunities lost. As we started doing this, you have to remember that we were probably right in the middle of the internet boom, and so that whole threat to libraries in particular of the dot-commers and the idea that there can be e-librarians and the press of the button and you can get your electronic book was very staring us very much in the face. I think in the last few months, we maybe are getting a little complacent and a little cocky as all of those dot-commers, or many of them, lost some steam. But the threat of what they were doing or the challenge of what they were doing is still very much there, and it's still very much what our users are looking for. So the approach to our vision, we wanted to take creative steps to maximize the use of our collections and our services. We wanted to look at statewide possibilities to address local needs. I think that's come up before. And as I said, we wanted to look from the outside in rather than the inside out. We wanted to look at what do our users want, not what do librarians want to give them or what do we think they need. So our vision, summed up probably, is that we think that Oregonians are best served if libraries remain at the center of our communities and campuses as providers of information services. It's come up earlier about selecting databases, about using our expertise, about being a gateway, about being a community center, and this is what's meant by this vision. Within that, we came up with 7 calls to action, and I will be going through these briefly. They're all here. I think what the vision does is it gives us something to work towards, and sometimes you come up with these calls to action, you think, great, we got 6 months to do this. This is Vision 2010. We're thinking of where we wanted to be in that, you know, now 8 years from now, not where we need to be tomorrow. It would be great if we could be there, but reality suggests those paths we can take, and we've just heard a real dose of reality from Department of Administrative Services. On the calls to action, one was a statewide library card, which is the idea that anybody could go into any publicly funded library anywhere in the state and check things out. The reality of that, as you saw earlier, is that not all Oregonians support a public library. So you have this question of served and unserved and who's supporting it. There are always costs involved. Information is not free. Running a library is not free. Interlibrary loan is not free. And local policies and procedures vary. We also saw, and this relates to the second call to action, which was about a library card or a catalog, that it's very complex in terms of library systems. We saw multiple maps and multiple schemes up there, and I think all of us are going, well, who does what? Where is there overlap? Where is this overlap of taxing jurisdictions, overlap of administrative systems, and just overlap of library systems? The statewide library catalog relates to the card in that we thought Oregonians should be able to access all the collections in the state from one point. Go into Corvallis Public,
as you saw earlier, put in your search and then be able to search everywhere throughout the state. There's technology. Reality is there's costs involved, and again, local policies and procedures vary. The one you've heard earlier when Patty was talking about CORE, this was one piece of the CORE legislation, which the concept that Oregonians should have a basic suite of good electronic resources that are appropriate to their age and their needs. Right now, the reality is that our expertise is not shared very efficiently. I think you ask questions saying, now, who's doing what? And yes, we're all doing a little bit of everything, from Orbis portals doing negotiation for licensing, all the way down to individual library systems negotiating for those specialized tools. Not everybody in the state wants access to ComIndex, which is the big engineering index. There's probably two of us who are willing to pay that much money, but somebody needs to negotiate that. And again, there are costs involved. One thing that makes this all work that we saw was the statewide high-speed network. We wanted all parts of the state to have access to a high-speed internet service. People get tired of me hearing that, but not Aletha, not those of us who are on the coast, but when you're in the metro area and the Willamette Valley, you take this for granted. As soon as you get out of the corridor, it's high-speed access is much more of a puzzle and a more difficult and expensive venture for libraries and for anybody. As I said, the reality is the last mile is the hardest. The State of Oregon Enterprise Network, the SOEN, is definitely a good solution towards this. Libraries just need to be at the table working on that, and that is where the state is, Jim might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, so is setting up contractual agreements with carriers to provide low-cost access to high-speed internet, and it is bringing it into the reach of many libraries. I think that Aletha Bromebrake would say there's still some of the small libraries that even that's going to be a challenge. But even when it's there, it costs to connect, and it costs to stay connected. Jim mentioned in his presentation the reference link system that came out of the 1992 committee's work. This vision is that we wanted expertise that's in our libraries to provide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, help for all of our users. We have a lot of expertise in the state, and we can use it better in terms of providing actual reference help to anywhere from that grade school student doing a homework assignment up to the research scientist. This is one area where the dot-commers were definitely very interested in what they could provide in terms of expert services, and I think libraries and librarians need to be right up there too. The reality is people are getting so they expect information on demand. I mean, you have grandchildren, I'm sure, who are just, you press the button and you want it there. We're now getting graduate students and faculty members who want the same thing but want it at a different level. The other reality is, though, that reference, the old-fashioned or the traditional type of reference, is very variable throughout all of our libraries. Some places are heavily used, others are not. And, of course, the 24/7 reference, it costs. And it's still somewhat of an untested model. But the library community is interested in helping to test it out. Service to all children sounds a little bit like a catch-all. The concept is we thought every child in this state should be able to learn the joy of reading as well as experience really quality information in their schools and their communities. The reality is that, again, not all Oregonians support a public library, and the number of school libraries is declining. It's a problem. Jim addressed that earlier, and it's something that we really need to focus on. The final call to action, which maybe seemed fairly far afield from this task force, which is, but in some ways is a foundation for all of these, is the workforce in libraries. We believe that we need a strong leadership and a strong library workforce that really reflects our demographics. And when we were looking at the scan of Oregon, one thing that was definitely came out was the changing demographics in the state. I'm a second-generation Oregonian, been here a long time, and
you can see it in my own community of Newport. We have a growing Latino community. You go up to the Portland metro area and you look at the school system up there, and they're dealing with 100 different languages. And yet our workforce in libraries tends to be fairly traditional. You look at this group, we're not the most diverse group. And we need to start building that diversity into our workforce. We also have an issue with many of it, as the baby boom generation moves through our workforce, especially in social services, some of the support industries, that there's going to be a large projected retirement coming up in the next decade. And it could be projected that we're going to lose as many as 40% of our librarians. I could have everybody here who's a librarian raise their hand who would like to be retired in 10 years to raise their hand, but I'm not sure if everybody would. But it could be a problem. We do not have a library school within the state. We stopped funding one in 1978. It was at U of O. One thing that came out of the last task force was work to get graduate education back in Oregon, and we do this through a distance program through Emporia State. And University of Washington is just starting out also on a distance program. So the options for people who want to stay somewhere close to home and get a graduate degree in librarianship, those are increasing. But again, there's some work that I think that we can do to make that easier and to encourage a more diverse workforce. So those seven calls to action, the part about moving those vision into reality, money was one thing, and Nan said, and Senator Troy reminded me, we're not supposed to talk about money. But we figure maybe in 10 years there'll be some money there. I think there's a lot of flexibility that we need to exercise. The library community is very committed to working collaboratively, to working through some of these calls to action. Some of them resonate more widely than others. And I think those are the ones you focus on first, and you keep building on the other ones. And then it's communication. This tool of the Vision 2010 is giving us a very good tool to talk to each other and try to get at what are the issues around these different calls to action. How can we, are the limited funding, can we move things around? Can you share expertise? What are the issues with the unserved? The issues between Eastern and the metro area are different, and yet our goal is the same, to really serve Oregonians better. I came up with a few ideas, as people know that I usually have a few ideas. Some of them I think that we should think broadly too, but things that would be a particular use in terms of the Vision 2010 is, some are very simple. A better tracking of school libraries, especially the expenses and staffing. Any tracking of school. This is very difficult information to get.
What do we mean by tracking?
Keeping statistics of expenditures and staffing levels, certification level. We have found through some work of one of the OLA committees that we can get the numbers, probably some basic demographics of school librarians, but it's still very hard to find out if somebody who is deemed the school media specialist is actually a certified media specialist or an aide that has been reassigned and is maybe assigned to three different components in a school. Expenditures are hard to track as a hard number because I think some school districts do not pull the library out as a cost center, but it's put into the principal's general fund, that type of work.
Mr. Chair, I'm just thinking, I feel terrible about it, but the State Department of Education had to cut the library specialist back in 1982 during the big budget cuts, and I had to make that decision, I remember. And I made horrible decisions. We couldn't help it. But I don't think they've ever been able to get back there. Lyle Wertanen was with us at that time, and I think it's kind of a sad commentary, and I feel kind of bad that I was a part of it, but that was a pretty bad time.
It's a very difficult time right now. I know that the Educational Media Association with the LSTA money did a very interesting study about the impact of school libraries on the success of students, and there's a a definite correlation there.
Well,
and yet,
I'm convinced of that.
We're really seeing a slide. In Lincoln County, my county, we have 3 certified media specialists to serve all of the schools. So that's 5 high schools, I think 5 middle schools, and probably 12 elementary schools.
Well, as you were talking about, I was just thinking those are kinds of things Lyle was on top of at that time. And that was at the same time you had 800 school librarians. And I think everything mm-hmm. started downhill, too. We were all cutting.
So there might be some other strategies we can use. The state library might be willing to pick up some of that statistical gathering at little to no cost to the state.
I think Carol has a question.
I was thinking two pieces. I'm on the budget commission for my school, so I've been tracking this also, and Corvallis is cutting school media people. But even in our vision statement, we say all children should experience the joy of reading. And to me, that's really not the point we're getting at here. We're really talking about what you just referenced, which is the success that children and then as they move through the school system can build on by understanding, knowing how to read and also understanding how to acquire information and repackage it. And so when we in our own vision statement say joy of reading, that sounds so sweet, but it really isn't it doesn't do anything. And I think that we might want to look at that statement and put a little punch to it, because it really is. I have no idea what the survey is if you surveyed the jails to find out how many illiterate people there are, but truly, if you can't read and you don't know how to get information in a society where you're changing your jobs every 5 years, you're totally disempowered. And it's sheer economics to me. It's not about joy of reading. It's just a successful society requires literate people, and literate people pay taxes, and as we get older, we want those people to be rich. And it's real simple,
I just want to add a point. I heard a saying just in the past couple of days that many librarians use when they go out and do fundraising, and that is that nobody ever graduated from a library and nobody ever graduated without one. So I think that sort of builds on what you're saying. It's more than just the joy of reading, right?
I think the joy of reading piece came from those who are new learners, and the idea that we focus so much on information that we forget that there's also is a joy of reading, that if people don't have that, they don't always buy into information. But I would also admit that this is probably the hardest one of our calls to action in terms of wordsmithing.
I'm sorry, Janet, but on the joy of reading, it also was focusing once more on the physical book as an experience instead of just what comes through some other information medium, and that was a component of it too.
Well, if I may, as an academic librarian, I think one of the things that all of us have noticed in the last few years is the great variance in the level of sophistication of the students that we're getting as freshmen in our colleges. They come from certain school districts. They may be fairly sophisticated and move easily into using the information resources we have in the library. From other districts, they're quite naive, and we need to do a lot of training. And maybe that's what Carol's getting at, that there is a real importance, I would think, of addressing that specifically, as well as the joy of reading, which, of course, we all understand and support.
Well, we're actually talking at Oregon State about setting up some reading programs, because our students can't read well enough to even get through an assignment. And these are college students who come in with high GPAs, but you watch them read and they're doing this, they're pointing at the words and their mouths are moving. And so we're thinking that something has to be happening earlier in the process, so when we get them, we're not having to spend our resources basically helping students to read faster. And that's why I think this is, to me, is so critical, because it cuts all over all of us. It's just a really critical thing, and that's why I'm sort of drawn and also pushing on it a bit, because it is important to us.
Most of us in higher education are really not funded to do remedial work that should have occurred in the K-12 level. It's as simple as that.
Other ideas, and I think these have already surfaced, that there's a need for coordination of e-resource licensing, whether that's done through funding staff at the state library or
pooling resources, but I think we can do a lot better job than we're doing now. The focusing of LSTA, the Library Services and Technology Act, the federal funds that we get on statewide initiatives. Mary Ganane will be talking about that. WICHE support for library education. This used to be a part of the WICHE funding, which is the in-state, out-of-state tuition reimbursement. It's a whole new twist when you start looking at distance education, but since the state does not support graduate-level library school, this might be something we want to look at, or what can we play around with this.
Is there any WICHE support now?
No, it's on the books, and it's it used to be, we used to fund it, but I don't think it's been funded for quite some time. And when I went recently and looked at the program, there are only a couple of states that are currently doing it. And my understanding has been there's not a mechanism for dealing with reimbursement in a distance situation. So it's, I think it's changing of the times, and maybe this is a whole other can of worms that maybe the WICHE program needs to be looked at. Other things that have come out is ground delivery, the courier system, some kind of basic delivery of services is another possibility. So I'll just leave you that, again, I think our vision is that we feel libraries have a very strong place in all of our communities, however you define community, as a central provider. I think our challenge today is, how do we play off the strengths and weaknesses of the status quo, which where we have great local support and strong local libraries and that fierce independence that's part of being an Oregonian. And we've made great strides over the last decade in terms of cooperation among our individual libraries. But how do we parlay that, I think, into the next decade and really move forward in terms of the amount of access that Oregonians have in a time that they're really going to need that information?
Hey, go ahead.
I'm going to make three points related to Janet's excellent presentation and many of you who are involved in it as well. First, one statistic that makes me shudder is that for every one person who enters a graduate library school with the intention of becoming a librarian, four retire. And that helps you see the kind of world we're really going to be in terms of who we can find to do the jobs we're talking about in the future. Second, I'm very concerned about the state of school libraries. In Multnomah County, the city of Portland's libraries are awful. And I don't just say that because it's what I understand to be the case. We had an LSTA grant to look at the state of school libraries in our county. There are eight districts in Multnomah County. That grant was to answer three questions. What's the state of school libraries in Multnomah County? What are some landmark or ideal programs throughout the country for public libraries supporting school libraries? And what might we in Multnomah County do? We've come up with good answers to all three of those questions, and I'll be happy to talk with you about them if you are interested at a later time. But I want to tell you the hardest one to answer was that first one, what's the state of school libraries? Janet said it very clearly. Even individual districts can't tell us how much they are spending on school libraries. And it would be wonderful to have a person dedicated to that at the Department of Education, but I'd be happy if there was just a couple of lines in the form that gets filled out, so that the local districts would find they had a reason to figure out how much they're spending on books. What we do know about Portland is that of the eight districts in Multnomah County, they are by far the worst, and I'll just give you the statistic that appalls me the most. In 1991, Portland Public Schools spent $12.67 per student. Last year, they spent $1.03. And they're losing staff, but more importantly, even when they have a person certified or not, full or part-time, they don't have money for books. They just aren't buying resources. We do everything we can. We spend literally millions of dollars to serve school kids in Multnomah County. And we do, and I can say this too because of the grant, about the best job in the nation. And we can't do what they are not doing. The third point, the first part of the vision is a statewide library card, and I want to call your attention to a success in that area. We would be having a different conversation now, and different conversations would have been held the last 15 years if Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County hadn't figured out how to give the residents of our three counties the virtual One Library card. And we do that by paying for the net imbalance of users. There's a contractual agreement between the three counties, and money changes hands. Money changes hands every year to enable people who live in Washington County to go into a library in Multnomah County, for a Multnomah County resident to go to Clackamas County, and throughout the metropolitan area, wherever you live in those three counties, you have the ability to use any public library. That's not free. And in fact, we have fought in the several times that we've done renewals of that agreement against some of the local politicians' concern, and I don't blame them for having it, about, you know, what do you mean 17% of our youth comes from someplace other than Multnomah County? We've just got to stop that. We've got to stop that. Well, the fact that there's an agreement in place and we get money, not 17% of our budget, but we get money, helps us say it makes sense to continue to do it. And it's that sort of nitty-gritty example that I think will be a useful one for us to look at as we're trying to figure out where we can implement that kind of an idea throughout Oregon. But please make no mistake of thinking this comes from goodwill or that it is free, because it's neither.
Would you do those, the $12 and the one, 12, what was it?
1991, $12 and, hang on, I've got it here.
And this is for library books, not textbooks.
For library books, not textbooks. For library books, not...
For library resources, because
yeah,
now,
resources,
now you'd
correct.
Also count in there any of the electronic...
Thank you. It was $12. I'm sorry, I've got it. I've got it right here now. And the numbers are a little bit different. I think I gave you numbers that were right, but the ones I have in here are for 1990. Portland spent for library resources $11.93. In 1999, they spent per pupil $1.17. It's gone down from there, and I think I gave you the lower figure at that time.
I think there's lots of horror stories we can tell about school libraries, which we don't need to depress ourselves more after the budget. But the one that I like or dislike the most is it's not just what you spend, it's what you have on your shelves. And there are certain high schools in the state that the average age of their collection is over 20 years old. That doesn't quite make it in the sciences, and especially when you're working with kids who don't know that difference between old information and what's current.
A friend of mine who's a principal at a middle school says the average book in her library is a copy written 1987.
Part of it, and I just noticed from working on our budget commission, is you know, it really has to do with Measure 5 in the schools, and what they're doing is they're just everybody's, you know, art's gone from the schools, PE's gone. All the what would be considered non-essentials are going, and it's not that anybody wants it to happen. It's simply that the money is so limited, and then I don't know if it's statewide, but we have site-based decision making, so the individual sites are making decisions about what they're going to do and what they're not going to do, and it's very difficult to see how the library community. This is bigger than the library community. This is an Oregon problem in terms of what we're going to do with K through 12 education and break that spiral that's going down, down, down. It's very, very serious.
Could I comment, Senator? I absolutely agree with Carol, but even in the most narrow view for what we in Oregon say matters, and that's with the testing for reading ability that's so critical, the third grade reading test, school libraries lead to success in those very measures that we say matters. So there's a straight line between what we say we want and good libraries. We just don't seem to be able to connect those lines. I agree. It's a bigger problem than we're likely to solve, though we're very creative and smart and we'll probably figure out a lot of things. But it's so fundamental and so wrong. I'd love us to do anything we can to help call attention to that problem.
Thank you.
Okay. What's next, Jim?
Well, we have one more presentation, Mr. Chair, and that is from Mary Ginnane, who is Director of Library Development at the Oregon State Library, and she's going to be giving us an overview of the LSTA.
Okay, very good.
Well, here. Is it going to work?
Yep. It is going to work.
Hey, how about it?
Thanks to Jim Wild. Okay. Chairperson Tro, members of the committee, task force. I'm Mary Ganane. I'm group leader at the Oregon State Library, and I'm here to talk about the Library Services and Technology Act. And I will be giving you an introduction to LSTA, talking about the funding, and then giving some examples of programs and projects which promote library cooperation. LSTA is Public Law 104-208. It was passed by Congress in 1997, and it actually replaces the Library Services and Construction Act. We have had a federal funding for libraries since the 1950s. It was first Library Services Act, then Library Services and Construction Act, and then that was re-engineered into the Library Services and Technology Act. The first year of funding of LSTA was in federal fiscal year 1998. It was enacted for 5 years initially, so 2002 is the fifth year of that first five-year cluster, and reauthorization is taking place now for the next 5 years. House Bill 3784, the Museum and Library Services Act of 2002, has just had some hearings in front of subcommittees at the congressional level. The statutory purpose of LSTA was to consolidate some federal library service programs. Part of the reengineering was to capture under one umbrella several different library funding programs. So some of the HEA library funds came in under Library Services and Technology Act. It's to promote improvement in library services in all types of libraries in order to better serve the people of the United States. The Act is also to facilitate access to resources in all types of libraries for the purpose of cultivating an educated and informed citizenry. And then the Act hopes to encourage resource sharing among all types of libraries so that there'll be economic and efficient delivery of service. I did want to point out that I am showing you purposes of the Act and allowable purposes for funding that come from the bill that's under consideration. This language is not the LSTA as it stands now, but what's being proposed. And my reading is that there's a lot of consensus around this new language, and we expect it to pass. So I thought it would better serve you.
Does the new language complicate what you're now doing in any way?
No, and it I think all the new language does is improve the Act by kind of streamlining the language, taking out some duplication. So it all of the basic purposes are still allowable. So in the Act, there are allowable purposes of funding, and again, these are the new language. To expand services for learning and access to information and educational resources in a variety of formats for individuals of all ages. An example of the old wording that correlates to this one is electronically linking libraries with educational, social, or information services. You can see that the intent is still much the same. Developing library services that provide all users access to information through local, state, regional, national, and international electronic networks. Providing electronic and other linkages among and between all types of libraries. And then to develop public and private partnerships with other agencies and community-based organizations. That particular cluster of purposes are really some of the purposes that come under the T of LSTA, Library Services and Technology Act. The remaining ones much more correlate to the basic function of the old LSCA to help underserved people, persons, have access to library service. So it's also allowable under LSTA to target library services to individuals of diverse geographic, cultural, and socioeconomic backgrounds, to individuals with disabilities, and to people with limited functional literacy or information skills. And it continues to be possible to use LSTA to target library and information services to persons having difficulty using a library and to underserved urban and rural communities, including children, with families, from families with incomes below the poverty line. And that's all defined in law. All right? Yes.
Go ahead, Carol.
Does that mean, I'm thinking about what Jenny was saying about reciprocal agreements and getting money for it. So when Jim showed us a chart of all of the unfunded areas, is it conceivable that those, that LSTA money could help work a reciprocal agreement where the people in unfunded areas, if they used libraries that were funded, that the libraries that were funded that served the unfunded could be reimbursed some way through LSTA money?
That would be allowable under the federal law. Then it would be a matter of, does our own local five-year state plan allow that?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, nothing would bar that. It definitely, to reach the unserved is the goal of LSTA.
And in fact, in Oregon, we have spent some of our LSTA and LSTA money to help get libraries organized, yes?
Yes, it's a big goal in Oregon to have the funds help reach the unserved.
I was saying not the ones that could be organized, but some of those, when he was showing us that chart, there were places in southeastern Oregon that didn't look like they had much happening. And so if they're isolated and they wanted library services, could those people go to a library outside of their area, but the library that provided them be reimbursed for serving the unfunded?
Can I answer that? I think our approach, Carol, has been, rather than use federal money on an ongoing basis to pay for service for the unserved, is to use LSTA as seed money to get those people to vote themselves a tax so that they have a library. That's what we're trying to do in Plain County, and that's our approach.
The Library Services and Technology Act is administered at the federal level by the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and so I'll refer to that as IMLS, that agency. So IMLS does require each state to submit a five-year state plan setting forth how we plan to use the federal funds to improve library development in each state. And it's basically a blueprint for using the federal funds. The next one for Oregon is due in July 2002, and we actually have an active process right now to develop that next five-year state plan. The LSTA Advisory Council, which is an appointed board or council of librarians representing different types of libraries and citizens representing library users. They are leading this process, and there's already been a two-day retreat where members of the library community came to help us draft objectives, and then there'll be more, a draft will be put out to the library community. There'll be more time for input, and eventually it'll come to approval by the State Library Board and then submission to the IMLS. And knowing that this group was going to be meeting and starting after we already started our five-year development process, where we've been trying to have a flexible approach to this LSTA five-year state plan and try to write things in flexible language that would allow different possibilities to happen. If we're not successful in matching that flexible language with whatever comes out of this task force, should there be something concerning LSTA coming out of this task force, we always have the ability to amend the five-year state plan with IMLS so that we're not locked in.
Are you likely to be putting into the five-year plan, as you see it developing now, additional innovations that we would need to know about as we do our work
What the retreat tried to do was to see that any of the ideas from Vision 2010 could be allowable through some language, whether it's explicitly stated as a goal for the five-year state plan. Is we're still working on that language, but we are trying to have the language allow certain possibilities.
But you see, basically, in your new plan, using the monies that you've gotten pretty much in the same way you have been using them, is that it? Provide the grants?
Why don't I describe how we have used the funding, and then it would be the LSTA Advisory Council that would propose anything different to the library community.
Okay.
I just wanted to give you a comparison between what the state received under LSCA, and that would be seen in the years 95, 96, 97, and then what we received under LSTA. What's reflected in those earlier years is the amount of money we got under LSCA for Titles I, which was to improve public library service, and Title III, which was to encourage resource sharing between libraries. So we got about $1.3 million, and it grew a little bit there toward the end. Because LSTA consolidated several library programs, we actually ended up, the whole program was funded at a higher level nationally, and so we in Oregon have gotten higher amounts than we got under LSCA. However, there's broader scope to LSTA in that all types of libraries are now eligible, and the technology component is stressed. So in the current federal fiscal year, we're getting $1.9 million. And as Jim referenced before, we expect that same level of funding to at least that same level to continue. Of course, the reauthorization at the national level, the stakeholders are planning to ask for more money. We don't know whether that will happen, but there seems to be support for continuing the program.
Questions, folks? Jim, you can ask questions.
Yeah.
You have questions.
This slide shows you how we are using the money in this current federal fiscal year, and I think it does give you a general picture of how we've used the funds over the past 5 years. There has been a big commitment in the state to have a large amount of the money available for competitive grants. And in 2002, the State Library Board has approved over $1 million worth of grants. And I did want to point out that about $46,000 of that is some unspent money from the previous federal fiscal year. So if anyone was trying to add up all these numbers, it would come out higher than our allotment. So Oregon Reference Link is that system of having five libraries be available to other libraries to help answer reference questions, and we've funded that this year at $189,000. Interlibrary loan net lender reimbursement, which reimburses libraries for net loans between other libraries and themselves, is targeted at $400,000, and that actually is the cap that is set in the Oregon administrative rules. If we were going to go over that, the State Library Board would have to make a special decision to do so. To date, we have not.
Is that cap realistic?
What's that?
Is the cap realistic? Is that an amount that makes sense?
To date, we have not exceeded the cap. This year is our highest year, and we're at $357,000. So we are creeping closer to the cap.
Okay.
I think what people in this room could confirm is even though the number of interlibrary loans to and from libraries are increasing, in terms of the nets, they're actually kind of staying fairly similar from year to year. It's just that the whole level has gone up, but people are borrowing more and they are loaning more, so the net turns out to be pretty even.
Go ahead.
The non-library people here might be interested to know that it's not a matter of the small libraries always borrowing from the big libraries. It's very much what you might not have, somebody else might have, and it's regardless of whatever size or amount of resources get spent. So it's just kind of an interesting way that works very effectively to share resources.
And then finally, we have authorization to use $300,000 for consulting programs at the State Library, grants administration, and some program support expenses. We have a technology planning consultant, grants administrator who also works with statistics, and a fund development consultant half-time that we offer services to libraries that are paid from the federal funds.
Does this kind of distribution of that money have general approval within the library community and generally works as well as any other kind of distribution you might have? Let's say you didn't give all the $1 million worth of grants, but you spent it on some other things. So how do we determine how we use the money and what makes sense in terms of how we use it?
I think that you will hear as this task force continues that there actually are some varying opinions about that. We've seen a lot of innovation and progress through the competitive grant program, and yet I know even Janet's OLA Vision 2010 presentation did talk about focusing LSTA more and perhaps having more statewide programs, and the LSTA Advisory Council heard that at the retreat that we just had also, that there's varying opinions about that. And you all ought to have some fun talking about it. In terms of projects and programs promoting library cooperation, I just tallied up over the 5 years what we spent on Oregon Reference Link. The reference referral program was $1.1 million. Netlender, interlibrary loan netlender reimbursement, including the proposed $400,000, would total $1.7 million. We've put money in through the competitive grant program into building some of the regional resource sharing systems. Jim had showed you some slides about the Southern Oregon Library Information System, which is a three-county integrated automated system. There's been several libraries which have gotten LSTA help to convert their automated system so that they're compatible with the Orbis system. The Hatfield Consortium is also being funded, some startup funding with LSTA that will help them then be part of Orbis. Database licensing, OSLIS stands for Oregon School Library Information System, and for 2 years they had some significant LSTA funds through the competitive grant program to build, to arrange for full-text database licenses for all school libraries and to build a front-end searching engine, somewhat of a search engine to it, to help students find what they need and to help teachers have knowledge of how to use the databases and integrate it into the curriculum. And then the public and academic statewide database licensing program did have 1 year of LSTA support and 1 year of LSCA support, so just the LSTA is reflected here. And then in terms of the competitive grant program, there's actually been almost $500,000 worth of funds distributed for individual projects that have ended up with something that the Oregon library community has access to over the internet. Orbis data for local communities is a current project, so that's not available yet. But the Oregon State University Valley Libraries had the had a grant for the government information sharing, which was an award-winning project that made available government information through some specially designed search front-end search engines. Salem Public Library has developed an online encyclopedia of history, local history information that is now available for anyone to search, and that was a 2-year project. Multnomah County Library had a wonderful 2-year project called Talk It Up, which increased the number of book discussion programs for youth in Multnomah County through both the public library and the school libraries. And a byproduct of that is a very excellent website on putting to how to put together book discussions for youth. Cluster of Polk, libraries in Polk County put together a community information network called the Polk Library Information Network. And then OSLIS, the School Library Information System, has a third year of funding to improve their website. So that's, I just focused on basically the technology grants that have been used and resulted in better library cooperation in Oregon. So I'll take any questions or we can move on.
You may not be the right one to ask this, but given Jenny's comments about the school libraries, are there federal funds that would be made available to do some of this monitoring of school libraries and try to get on top of that?
Yeah, just this past year, for the first time in a long, long time, there actually is some school library funding, but it's meant for library resources at the federal level, and it was just a small amount that was approved nationally. I think it will be very competitive, so I think the chances of using it for that school still, you know, taking a snapshot of schools is probably not appropriate.
And Jim, you can probably help me out with this too. I think over the last 15 years, we've seen something happening to school libraries. It used to be that there was categorical federal money that was required to go to school libraries, and every school library saw some of it. That changed and became, and school libraries were a part of what was covered with federal block grant money. So schools had local decisions to make about what they would spend it on. And as happens almost always, they spent it on today's emergency, and the long-term need of libraries sort of went begging at that time. But that's been the history that school library people would tell us about. I see you nodding. Am I doing it right?
Come join us. Identify yourself.
Cheryl Steinke, Eugene School District. Senator Burdick, your question had to do with recent funding. I couldn't hear it, but I think I know what you're...
Whether there was funding available for some of these needs that we have, both for resources and for gathering the data about where they stand.
Just in December, as part of the Leave No Child Behind legislation out of the federal government, there was a small chunk of money nationally. It's only $12.5 million that is for school. Five different categories, but one of them is school library materials and other ways that school libraries could use money. That particular money will not come through the state. It will go directly from the federal government to school districts, and no grant will be more than $50,000, and you have to have a 20% poverty rate in your district to qualify. So
basically, the answer to your question is no.
No schools would qualify, huh?
Pretty close.
Okay, thank you. It's been a pleasure presenting
this
information.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions before Mary Janine runs away? Okay, thank you. Okay. Now, does that bring us to the end of our formal presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That concludes all invited testimony. And actually, from a timing standpoint, we pretty well got caught back up, which is great. Unless there's further discussion, I guess we'd want to close the informational meeting and open up a work session to announce the members of the subcommittees.
Are there additional questions that anybody would have before we do that? Okay, then let's open up the work session and organize some subcommittees and go to work as subcommittees. All right.
Okay. As I had mentioned earlier today, there are two subcommittees to this task force. Subcommittee on Solution Identification, which Senator Duncan has agreed to chair, and then the Subcommittee on Legislative Proposal Development, which Senator Burdick has agreed to chair. We are going to be breaking out from here and going into both subcommittees. The Subcommittee on Solution Identification, it was suggested that Janet Webster, Deborah Carver, and Aletha Bonebrake participate on that subcommittee. And on the Subcommittee on Legislative Proposal Development, Carol Butcher, Connie Bennett, and Larry Oberg participate. That means that we do have Jim Shepke and Ginny Cooper, who have not been assigned to subcommittees, but as the chair had suggested to staff, would eagerly ask their participation working with the subcommittees.
Now, one subcommittee will do quite a bit of work this afternoon. The other one will meet briefly, right?
And, that's correct.
And then sort of wait. So what we invite everybody to do is to, on the one that's not going to do a whole lot today, is to go meet and organize and then come back and join us and help, because we're going to do some group thinking, right, and try to suggest things that we might consider doing from this task force with the subcommittee. And those not assigned to the subcommittee, would just stay with the one that's working and help us work, okay?
Mr. Chair, I think it's very interesting. We have two committees. One is the Solutions Committee, and the other one is the Legislature. And I can certainly see why there's got to be a mess.
No overlap.
Well, we're hoping, Senator, that that the Solutions Committee will find its way to the Legislative Committee with some solutions that we can do in the next session. I hope that's the case.
Mr. Chair, the Subcommittee on Solution Identification will be meeting here in room 343, and the Subcommittee on Legislative Proposal Development will be meeting in room 50 downstairs. And Annetta has asked that I please ask the subcommittee members to take your nameplates with you to the new meeting room. Was there anything else they needed to take, Annetta? Oh, and your pencils.
Why don't I give, since we're going to be a hardworking committee and really get at it, I want to give you a 10-minute break before we go right at it.
Senator,
okay.
All right.
I think it's a process question. We having the working committee solution identification. We're supposed to kind of solve our problems and then forward that on to the other subcommittee. And then the May meeting will be a discussion of the legislation.
Mr. Chair, today the subcommittee on solution identification will discuss the barriers that were brought out in the testimony today, and then working with Jim Shepke, identify best practices and what other states are doing to address the issues that we've identified here, and based on that conversation, then come up with some solution ideas that then can be given to the Subcommittee on Legislative Proposal Development. In the May in the May subcommittee meeting, Senator Burdick's subcommittee then will take a look at the recommendations that come out of the discussion today and start looking at possible places where they can develop legislation.
Now, although we just have three formal meetings, there's no reason why subcommittees can't visit during the interim, and if we don't get things brought up now, you can come forward at the next meeting with those things. We really don't have a lot of time in formal meetings to do very important things, but we do have a lot of time in terms of just months before we get to the next session or to the last meeting of this committee when we try to authorize some things to be done. And so if we can have kind of your collective thinking and you can correspond and talk to each other during the interim and talk to your chairs, obviously, and see what we can come up with. As I recall, the other task force we had a few years ago, we had sort of informal meetings before we, and then we went through the formal process. Yeah, Jim, do you want to?
Well, I was actually going to ask a question, Senator Tro, and you just alluded to it in your remarks. But my question is it if a subcommittee wanted to have a meeting between our formal meetings, would that be possible so long as we do that at no expense to the state?
I would think so. Right.
The only thing we would have to watch is we become a legal entity, and we have to give public notice. So we'd have to work through Jim and do that.
I think maybe
we can do it.
We communicate with each other informally without maybe having meetings, and then gear your meeting to the time when we're having a formal meeting.
It would be legitimate to have email conversations, sure, about issues. Is that correct?
Yes. We just have to be sure with the four-member committee that Let's see.
You can have a majority together at any time.
Okay, so we're going to take our 10 minutes and then
10 minutes
reassemble.
And we'll be right back. Okay.